Walk into Hangar 3 at the National Museum of the United States Air Force in Dayton, Ohio, and the Valkyrie will hit you before you have time to read a single placard. It is white, pure, cold, clinical white, and it is enormous in a way that photographs do not prepare you for. 196 feet long, longer than the Wright brothers' entire first flight at Kitty Hawk. Six engine nozzles lined up in a row at the tail, like something from the cover of a science fiction paperback. Canards, those forward fins, jutting out ahead of the fuselage with absolute confidence. And the delta wing, massive and low slung, the wingtips canted downward at an angle that looks like an afterthought but is, in fact, the most brilliant piece of aerodynamic engineering this country ever produced at scale. I stood in front of it for about 10 minutes before I said a word to the person next to me. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and today on the Hangar, we're talking about the North American XB-70 Valkyrie, the fastest, highest-flying, most technologically audacious bomber America ever designed and built, the one that arrived just in time to become obsolete before it ever dropped a weapon in anger, and the one that carries a story inside it that still aches if you know where to look. Before we get into it, today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in your flying life. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, commercial certificate, ATP, they have a coin for every step you've earned. These aren't trinkets, every one of them is a physical reminder of something you worked for, something you passed through. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. AviationSoul.com now. To understand the Valkyrie, you have to understand the world that wanted it built. It was 1954. The United States Air Force had just taken delivery of the B-52 Stratofortress, which was and remains one of the finest aircraft ever built. But the strategists weren't satisfied. The thinking at the time was that the next generation nuclear bomber had to be faster, much faster. Fast enough that Soviet air defenses simply couldn't engage it. So the Air Force issued a requirement. They wanted a strategic bomber capable of sustained cruise flight at Mach 3, roughly 2,000 miles per hour, at altitudes above 70,000 feet. They wanted it to carry nuclear weapons from bases in the continental United States, penetrate deep into Soviet territory, deliver its payload and egress before the defenses could get a missile into the air. North American Aviation, the same company that gave us the P-51 Mustang and would later give us the X-15, won the contract. The engineers at North American faced a problem that nobody had solved at that scale. When you fly at Mach 3, the air compresses against the leading edges with such violence that the friction generates enormous heat. Skin temperatures on the order of 500 degrees Fahrenheit and higher. Aluminum, the material that built most of aviation up to that point, would soften and fail at those temperatures. So the Valkyrie was built out of stainless steel honeycomb panels bonded together, titanium, where titanium was needed, and a smattering of other exotic materials that in 1954 barely existed in production quantities. The airframe was essentially a flying furnace that had to remain perfectly structural while the atmosphere tried to cook it alive, and it had to do this for hours at a time. They solved it, but that was just problem number one. Problem two was propulsion. Six General Electric YJ-93 turbojet engines, each one roughly the length of a mid-size automobile. At max power, the combined thrust of all six was in the neighborhood of 180,000 pounds. At cruise, the aircraft burned fuel at a rate that would have emptied the tanks of a Cessna 172 in under a minute flat. The Valkyrie carried a specialized high-energy kerosene called JP6, developed specifically for this program, nearly 50,000 gallons of it. The aircraft at max takeoff weight was somewhere north of 500,000 pounds. Heavier than a loaded Boeing 747, and yet it flew, and flew well. The first flight was September 21, 1964. Test pilot Alvin White lifted AV-1, Aircraft Vehicle 1, off the runway at Air Force Plant 42 in Palmdale, California. The six YJ-93 engines made a sound that people at the field that day described differently. Some said it was a roar. Some said it was more of a sustained low vibration you felt in your chest before your ears fully registered it. White flew 61 minutes and landed it without incident. He later said the aircraft was remarkably stable and responsive for something its size. Now, here's the piece of engineering that I want you to stop and think about, because this is what separates the Valkyrie from every other big fast aircraft that came before it. Compression lift. At high Mach numbers, the shockwave generated ahead of the aircraft creates an enormous zone of compressed high-pressure air. Most aircraft just plow through it and deal with the drag. North American's engineers figured out a way to use it. The key was the delta wing and those downward-canted wingtips. At low speed and low altitude, the wingtips rode flat. But as the aircraft accelerated through Mach 0.5 or so, the outer sections of each wingtip folded down by 65 degrees. This effectively funneled the supersonic shockwave underneath the aircraft and trapped it against the underside of the wing. That compressed air became an additional lifting surface. The aircraft was, in effect, riding its own shockwave the way a surfboard rides a wave. This is not a metaphor. This is what the airplane actually did. On its third flight, the Valkyrie touched Mach 1.4. On its 14th flight, it reached Mach 3 for the first time. The wingtips folded, the shockwave engaged, and a 250-foot aircraft rode a wall of compressed air at 2,000 miles per hour across the Nevada desert. There are maybe a handful of aircraft in history that ever sustained cruise flight at Mach 3. The Valkyrie is one of them. The SR-71 Blackbird is another. That's a very short list. But here is the cruel, grinding irony at the center of this story. By the time the Valkyrie was flying those missions, the world it was designed for had already changed. Two things happened in rapid succession. In May of 1960, the Soviets shot down a Lockheed U-2 reconnaissance aircraft flown by Gary Powers at approximately 70,000 feet over Sverdlovsk. The surface-to-air missile that brought him down rewrote what military planners thought they knew about high-altitude sanctuary. If a U-2 at 70,000 feet was vulnerable, then a bomber at 70,000 feet was vulnerable too, no matter how fast it was traveling. The high-altitude penetration concept that the Valkyrie was built around had just taken a serious wound. The second blow was quieter but more decisive. Intercontinental ballistic missiles had arrived. The Atlas, the Titan, the Minuteman. A missile has no crew to lose. A missile can be launched from a silo in Wyoming and impact a target in the Soviet Union in under 30 minutes. A missile doesn't need to fly home. A missile sitting underground is essentially invulnerable until the moment of launch. Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara looked at those two facts and then looked at the Valkyrie program budget. Each aircraft was costing somewhere in the neighborhood of $750 million in 1960 dollars. He looked at the development curve and saw the costs climbing. He looked at the strategic calculus and saw a manned penetration bomber that the missiles were rendering redundant. The program was cut from a production aircraft to a research aircraft, two prototypes only. That's all that would ever be built. AV-1 and AV-2. Now here's what I want to be clear about. The research value of those two aircraft was real and substantial. The Valkyrie was generating data on sustained Mach 3 flight that didn't exist anywhere else. Structural thermal loads, aerodynamic stability, sonic boom propagation. Because one of the concerns about a civilian supersonic transport, which people were already talking about in the early 1960s, was what 300 sonic booms a day over the United States would do to windows and nerves and lawsuits. The data the Valkyrie collected fed directly into NASA's supersonic transport research program. The aircraft was doing useful work, and then came June 8, 1966. General Electric had arranged a photo flight. The company wanted an aerial photograph of several aircraft that used its engines, all flying together in formation. The lineup was impressive. AV-2, the second Valkyrie. A Lockheed YF-12, a Northrop T-38 Talon, a McDonnell F-4B Phantom, and a Lockheed F-104 Starfighter. The F-104 was being flown by Joe Walker. Joe Walker was not just any test pilot. Walker had flown the X-15 to altitudes above the 50-mile threshold that defines the boundary of space. He had done it twice. He was a National Aeronautics and Space Administration research pilot, decorated, experienced, as capable a stick-and-rudder man as existed in the world at that moment. The photo ship was a Learjet. They were flying in loose formation over the Mojave Desert, low and slow for the cameras. The formations required some maneuvering at some point during a photo pass. Walker's F-104 drifted into the wingtip vortex trailing off AV-2. The vortex caught the Starfighter and rolled it inverted in an instant. The underside of the F-104 struck the left wingtip of the Valkyrie. Joe Walker was killed immediately. The XB-70 AV-2 continued flying for a moment. Alvin White and co-pilot Major Carl Cross were in the cockpit and had no immediate way to know what had happened behind and below them. Then the aircraft began to roll. Both vertical stabilizers had been sheared away in the collision. Without them, the Valkyrie had nothing to fight the roll with. It rolled slowly at first, then faster. White and Cross were equipped with individual escape capsules, not conventional ejection seats. The Valkyrie flew high and fast enough that a standard seat would have been survivable in very few scenarios at altitude. The capsule system was designed to enclose each crew member before ejection, protecting them from the air blast. White got his capsule closed, he ejected. He survived, though, with serious injuries. Cross could not get his capsule closed in time. AV-2 impacted the desert floor. Three people connected to that day did not go home. The program was over in any practical sense. AV-1 flew a handful more times, completing research missions, gathering the last of its data. 78 total flights across both aircraft combined. On February 4, 1969, Alvin White, the same man who flew that first 61-minute hop in 1964, the same man who ejected from AV-2 in 66, ferried AV-1 from Edwards Air Force Base to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, he handed it to the museum. It has not moved since. Now here's what I think about when I stand in front of it. Every piece of engineering on that aircraft was done without computers as we understand them today. The aerodynamics were worked out with slide rules, drafting tables, and wind tunnel time. When the engineers proposed the compression lift concept, capturing a shockwave as a lifting surface, there was no simulation to run it through. There was math, there was wind tunnel data, and then there was the airplane. And brave men willing to find out. The canards on the nose. The six engine inlets, each one carefully designed to manage the supersonic airflow entering the compressor face. The thermal protection system built from stainless steel honeycomb, the wingtip fold mechanism. All of it designed, verified, and built in an era when the most powerful computational tool in the building was the human brain with a slide rule in its hand. The fact that it worked is not a small thing. The fact that the world had changed before it could serve the purpose it was built for that is the kind of tragedy that runs through aviation history like a seam. The right aircraft at the wrong moment. A machine that was technically brilliant and strategically orphaned before it ever reached maturity. There's a photograph from the morning of June 8, 1966. All five aircraft in formation, banking gently over the Mojave, the Valkyrie white and enormous in the center, Joe Walker's F1, O4 tucked in close on the right. The light is sharp and clean, the kind of morning light you get in the high desert. Everyone in that photograph looks effortless. It was taken minutes before the collision. When you stand next to AV-1 in Dayton, you are standing next to the only XB-70 left on Earth. The other one is fragments in a California desert. This one is the airplane. The actual airplane. Not a reproduction. Not a mock-up. The aircraft Alvin White flew for the first time in September of 64 and delivered to the museum 5 years later. If you have never been to the National Museum of the United States Air Force, I'll tell you this. Admission is free, parking is free, it's in Dayton, and it houses the finest collection of aviation hardware in the world under a single roof. Four connected hangars, presidential aircraft, Korean War jets, Cold War bombers, research aircraft that flew once and landed into history. Hangar 3 alone is worth a day of your life. The Valkyrie is at the far end. You will see it from a distance. You will think you understand how big it is from the photographs. You don't. Go find out. Much of today's history comes from the Air Force Historical Research Agency, the National Museum of the United States Air Force's published documentation, and the research of aviation historian Joe Backer. Find us at radiohangar.com. I'm Tail Dragger. Keep the blue side up.